Morning, brothers and sisters. So great to be here to finally come back to a place I could really call home, because home has recently gotten a definition for me, which is a place where you don't need to pack up in 2 weeks. So it's very relieving. You think all these traveling would just turn me into an expert in packing and traveling? No, it just turned me into an expert of stressing myself out over these things. So I'm very happy to be here in Pacific Grace. For those of you who may not have known me yet, my name is Ian. I have been here for a long time, and I'm a member of... that's how it works. Thanks. I kept pointing at this thing this morning. Anyways, so yeah, Wycliffe Bible Translators is a missionary organization that serves minority language groups in the whole world. And what we do is, other than Bible translation, we want people to understand the Word of God, but we also want them to grow strong communities. We want them to build literacy, education, all these language-related things. This is what we do, and I'm a member. And whenever people hear me being a Wycliffe member, they say, what language are you translating the Bible into? And it's kind of embarrassing because I don't actually translate Bibles. Because what I do is I do language surveys and assessment. Because when we start a Bible translation program, hopefully before we start, we get all the facts together and we come to make some informed decisions, like what languages do they actually speak? What language is a good language to put the Word of God in? You have all these dialects. You don't want to end up picking the one that the least people speak or approve of. Or what should go first? Do you go for literacy first? Do you want to go with community development? Do you want to go with the translation project? Or do you want to... How do you plan the whole thing? And also, we also do awareness raising for the communities by doing survey and finding out about them, telling people about them. So that's what I do. The projector. So I have been to this country that I'm not supposed to name, and all these places in this country. And the biggest, anybody notice where the biggest arrow is? Yeah, more specifically, Hong Kong. It's a nice place to be, but it's not really the ideal case situation. But I didn't actually get a work visa properly, so I can't really stay in the country. I keep having to go back, leave within a month on these visa on arrivals. So the red parts starting in January, I didn't get to go. I kept waiting for my visa until May. And then I go and I have to go to somewhere, hopefully not as far as Vancouver is from where I'm supposed to serve. So Hong Kong kind of worked. And then go back again, and then back and forth again, and again. So that's what I did. And I did a lot of funny things. GLP and PMAC and all these acronyms. We have a whole ton of these. I'm still learning, I'm telling you. And they're coming in multiple languages. And it's like, I don't know why I still haven't gone crazy over these. But the GLP is a guide to language learning. What we do is, when we do language assessment or survey, we want to find out how they use the language. The old way is we have a questionnaire. We go to the village or the town, and then we just try our best to randomly pick people and ask them questions, and then get our questionnaires. We still do some of these things. And the other thing we do is we want actual language data. So we bring our recorders. We go and record them. And sometimes we need to do testing. We want to find out whether they can speak or understand maybe a translation or literature in the majority language. So we come to a village that is not particularly technologically advanced, and we come with all these equipment, these microphones and recorders and all these weird things, and you put headsets on their heads over their ears, and then you try to test them. It's kind of intimidating. And sometimes it doesn't really, it kind of confuses the community, and it doesn't necessarily get us very good data, because it's hard to plan when you're not one of them. They actually know a lot about their language, how they use it, and what's best, and so on, but we never asked. So the GRP is one way we try to change the approach. PMAC stands for participatory methods. So we want them to participate. We want them to be engaged. Participatory methods for engaging communities. So we want them to talk about their language to us, what they want to do, what they feel about it, using it, and stuff like that, instead of having us just go into the places and then do all these recordings and other scary things. So the problem is, I was really excited when I first set out. I was like, you just served long enough in the church, you might have gotten your share of frustration over how everything is just kind of just whatever you have, kind of you have to just make things up on the fly. And I was like, I'm going to the field, I'll be working with seasoned professionals, I'll be working with spiritual giants, I'll be working with committed servants of God. That's exciting. Things will work. Things will be done in the right way. We can take on any storms. But actually, you have more, or at least in my situation, as you will hear more, I ended up doing more things on the fly, more last-minute preparations, more unprepared things. And then it just got me thinking, why is it such a mess? Why is it so hard to just prepare well and do ministry well? We see things that are not done or not done properly, other thing done which is actually irrelevant, and we also see people get hurt, get frustrated, and burn out. So what is wrong with our ministry? Let's look at why we need survey. This is the biggest head is mine. And I was on a small plane flying to an island in the eastern part of my assignment country. And we're going to do a GOP training over there. We are trying to help the community find ways to assess the language situation. And we come across a mother tongue translator who has been working on his language for a long time. The project started in 1985. New Testament is done in 2008. They even had a dedication a few years ago. So it was a population about 10,000, not very big, but kind of big enough to worth doing something about. And we find that this translation is done, it's all good, but nobody's reading the Bible. Nobody's using this translation. And we're like, what? You spent, how many years is that? 2008 minus 1985? Anybody? It's good at math. So like 20-some years, 23 years, doing, pouring out your life, your energy and resources and everything, and getting these people trying to end up with a Bible translation that doesn't get read. Turns out there are a few issues. One of the things is they don't really get the attention or the approval from the synod. That particular denomination work in a synod structure, and everything is decided along the hierarchy, top down. So you have your pastors sent by the synod into the classes and things like that, and you and you do what you're told to do. So they don't say use some other tongue translation, so they don't use it. That's one reason. But from what we've come to learn in our years of doing Bible translation, we realize there are a few things that need to be in place for a Bible translation to be used. If you've ever wondered why maybe you are trying to promote people to read the Bible in fellowship, in church, in your groups, and people aren't really catching up on that, you might as well think about this. People need to have the spiritual hunger. They need to desire the Bible. They need to desire the truth. Or else why would you read the Bible? They need to have it in an appropriate language, a language they can understand. If we only have the Bible in Greek, where would we be if it was never translated into other languages, into English, into Chinese? It needs to be acceptable. It could be maybe it's one language with different dialects. And if you happen to pick the wrong dialect, that everything is like the back country, the rural kind of dialect that the city people kind of look down on, and they don't accept it. They're like, why did you pick the worst form of a language? Or something like that. There are other things, but it has to be acceptable. It also has to be accessible in a way that if people don't know how to read and write and you have a printed Bible, what do you want them to do with it? Right? So we need to explore different forms. It might be in MP3 recordings. It might be in audio. It might be visual. It might be storytelling. It might be in print form. People also need to understand it apart from language and other barriers. They need to have a certain basic understanding of the Bible and what it's about in order to understand Bible teachings. And also, if you have all of these and then you have a Bible that sells for like $1,000, who's going to get it? Who's going to read it? Nobody's going to be able to afford it. So it has to be obtainable through some distribution channel. And also, there has to be a freedom for them to commit to faith, commit to reading the Bible, to commit to using it. So if we don't have these, we know we're going to run into issues, even if we have the best translation into this vernacular language. So this is a recorder. This is, I don't know if this is a very professional grade recorder. It looks quite professional to me. And it seemed to work really well. And I think we have a few of those in our survey team. Problem is, this is a recorder that we didn't bring. So how did that happen? I don't know if you've ever served on a ministry team where you have a whole group of people, they're very dedicated, but nobody knows what's supposed to be done. Everybody's just equally clueless. In my assignment country, we used to have one of the best survey teams ever. Other people look to us on how you put together survey training, how you put together a survey team and a survey plan. But some things happened down the road some years ago, and the government is not letting us sponsor visas, and a lot of expats had to go. Among other things, that was a huge blow. We used to have hundreds of people, and then we have two teams, one on the east, one on the west side of the country. And we end up with a lot of these equipment, very good quality. We have the current team in my last survey trip, we have one staff who hasn't finished his training because the team leader left. And we have one staff with experience doing only a simpler form of rapid appraisal kind of survey on the east side of the country where things are different. Languages are very small, very isolated. You have a whole ton of them. It's one big island with over 200 languages. And then we come to another part. We have one huge ethnic group that's supposed to speak maybe 100 different variants of language or languages. We still need to find out. But then they're very similar. So on the east, you can use a word list that has maybe about 200, 300 items. And you can tell them apart. On the central part, it doesn't work. Because they sound all so similar. We're still trying to figure out a good way of doing surveying in this area. But then this member with experience, her expertise, she actually got her degree in national administration. So I was like, how did you end up in the survey team doing linguistic stuff? And then we have one staff from a partner organization on the same survey team whose expertise is animal husbandry. So he knows how to pick the best cow or out of a herd and things like that, how to properly raise farm animals. But he doesn't really have a lot of idea about how to do survey. And then we have a supervisor with even more experience, but she's just too busy to do any of these things. So nobody has proper linguistic or sociolinguistic background for the job. And we have out-of-country consultants, people who still want to serve, and then they kind of stay in places like Malaysia or Philippines or Thailand, and you can still contact them through email. Problem is, I was the only one asking around and trying to make contact with them. None of those team members knew or ever tried or wanted to ask, because they only know what to do. They only know to do what they know to do. So when I went out, I was kind of hoping or expecting that I would get into a kind of a mentorship or internship, and there would be some guy more experienced telling me what to do, teaching me things, letting me try things and break things, and hopefully he'll pick up. No, I turned out to be the expert in the house, which is really wrong. Really wrong. Because I don't have any field experience. I'm trying to gain field experience in these few starting years. And then I was not exactly put in charge, but people kind of... We just kind of realized I have more ideas about how to do this than some of them. They're still dedicated people trying to get things done, and they did, but I just can't help but think, what's really wrong? Why is it? It really bothers me because I was hoping, it's kind of like talking bad about my organization, but we have a huge international, world-renowned missionary organization operating in like over 60 countries. We have like 6,000 people all over the world, 6,000 members. We've been doing this for so many years, and we come to a point where like I'm the expert. So, yeah, is there something wrong? What should we do about it? And am I even supposed to expect things to be better, or is it just normal to be in a mess? So, in all my frustration and in God's mercy and grace, He showed me this Bible passage and really pointed out something's wrong with my logic. So in Luke chapter 17, Jesus told a parable about servants. Suppose one of you has a servant plowing, looking after the sheep. Will he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, "Come along now and sit down to eat"? Won't he rather say, "Prepare my supper, get yourself ready and wait on me While I eat and drink, after that you may eat and drink. Well, he thanked the servant because he did what he was told to do. So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, we're just unworthy servants. We have only done our duty. It really struck home to my heart. I just can't help but think. I kind of expected things to be good. We're professionals. We do things. We do great things. When it's one thing for us to just get used to saying, oh, we shouldn't expect reward from our service. Like, we just witnessed how we have a great church with a ton of humble servants who is not willing to take credits for their Sunday school and worship and so on. But then it's kind of a different thing when we expect, when we do it, we have what we think we need to do the job properly. And I still think, we need to keep improving. But something goes wrong when we kind of turn our expectation into a demand that just, now we have a good reason to just get upset with God because you're not putting things together. But that's wrong. Jesus says you are the servant. You do what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to get special treatment. You're not supposed to get first class air tickets because you travel a lot. You're not supposed to get all the expert help you need because you're doing survey. So the passage really talks about, and the context talks about, all about being a disciple. There's a warning about causing disciples to stumble. There's an instruction about you need to confront the sinner, but you need to forgive the penitent. You need to forgive when they turn back from their sins. And then when the disciples heard that, they were like, oh no, we don't have enough faith for that. And then Jesus said, you don't need a lot of faith for that. You need faith, but you don't need a lot. A little faith can move mountains. You can just tell this tree to get uprooted and go into the sea, and it will go. And then we come to this parable. You may have great faith. You may have great expertise. You may have all these great things that make you proud. But at the end of the day, you are just a servant. You're supposed to do what you're told to do. Remember, and don't feel entitled to things. Don't feel entitled to your way of doing things. And when you take it a step further, you think, if you are Jesus, you have a mission to come to the world and rescue humanity, and you get to pick 12 people. Who are you going to pick? Well, who did Jesus pick? You get fishermen, and more fishermen, and I guess in the area they have a lot of fishermen. And there's a tax collector, and there are all kinds of people. But you don't get missionaries, you don't get evangelists, you don't get spiritual giants, you don't get experts. You get fishermen and tax collectors and whoever you happen to have. Well, God has plans, but one of the thing he planned is that he chose the foolish people, foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose those who are weak to shame the strong. God didn't choose you and I because we're smart, because he made us smart if we were. God chose us because we are weak, because we're foolish, because we're useless, so that when it gets done, God gets the glory, not us. On another aspect, there's an issue with teamwork. You have all these committed people, committed servants of God, coming together, trying to to do some great things for his kingdom. But people get into conflicts. We're not actually arguing. We just, for some reason, we're talking about the food, but yeah, it was distorted. We were on good terms. But as it turns out, even committed, well-trained, and good servants of the Lord don't necessarily always make a great team. I was going to tell something about the trip I went on in around August, at the end of July and August. And we went to this participatory methods training. At first, I thought I was just going to the training and maybe in the future I will use it. Turns out the future is 2 weeks later. I need to be training people and I don't even have a chance to practice what I learned 2 weeks ago. I mean, we have a lot of flexibility demands. Half of our team had no experience with the methods except what we learned 2 weeks ago. We trained participants from 4 different language groups. We learned 4 tools from the training, and then turns out, oh, the team leader, when he put together a plan, oh, we have 3 new tools. And then in that limited time, we need to figure out, well, what do these actually do? How do they actually work? And then we're like, that's how it works. So, and we had a 5-day workshop originally, but then some participants are too far off. They didn't get cell phone signal, and they didn't get the right time. And then it was very far, and they came a day late. So we had to cram the whole thing into 4 days, and then we have to take out the practicum. We have to do all kinds of accommodations. We were just going haywire on this. And then with all these time schedule crashes, one thing happened was very important figure, a pastor who is kind of the leader of a few different churches. He was very hospitable, and he invited us to his granddaughter's birthday party. So we're like, oh, wow, that's so nice of him, but we have a meeting with the participants. We need to work. But then it's not nice when people invite you and you just turn them down. So what do you do? So our team leader, in all his wisdom, decided it would be very prestigious to send some of these expat people to attend the thing, and then the rest of them will deal with the participants. And then we didn't really get the logic, and we didn't understand why we have to go to this. We need to work, right? We could just work on things together, but then, yeah. One of the team members asked the leader. He tried to explain. And then after a while, another member went and asked again. And then the third time when I was asking, he was like, he was kind of getting ruffled. He was trying very hard to hold himself back from like lashing out on us. But then we had a pretty bad fallout. And then at one point, the leader just said, I'm the leader, and I expect that I have the right to make the calls. So essentially, he's just notifying us of what he's decided to do, and we're like, how could you do that? And then it wasn't easy. And one member, actually, she just said, why is it so hard? She's been praying, she's been waiting for a chance to get involved in Bible translation. She's a national. And she's been praying for 13 years, and she was like, this is exciting, I'm getting... And then she just broke down in tears. Why does that have to be so hard? I guess one of the few things that came into my mind is when we come to a place with a different culture, or actually when we come to any place with a culture, we need to think of what affects
status or prestige or who is supposed to listen to whom and who is supposed to be listened to. In Southeast Asia, I think it also applies pretty much to Chinese culture, doesn't it? If you have a high position, if you're senior, if you're old, they respect old people. If you have proper affiliations, you know the big guns. If you are the expert, you just know it all. If you're an insider, if you're a Caucasian, if you're an expat, if you're wealthy or powerful, or even like in a place where people by the majority don't speak English as a everyday language, speaking English when you work with a whole bunch of expats, it gives you an advantage, it gives you status. On the other side, if you're low, you're junior, you're young, they say I'm like 17 years old. So if you know nobody, if you're untrained and all these things, you just, it doesn't get your say, you don't get your say, you don't get listened to. You have to listen to people. And even with just this, this is, all right, this is kind of clear. What is not clear and confusing is something like my situation. I am kind of having a low position. I'm a new guy on a job. I'm a junior. I'm young. I know nobody. But I'm an expert, sort of. But then I'm an outsider. I'm not one of the local people. I'm not Caucasian, but I'm expat. I wouldn't really say I am rich and powerful, but then to comparatively speaking, they would see me as having more means than they do. And I speak English. So am I supposed to have say, or am I supposed to just listen and obey? A lot of times conflicts happen not because of differences, and not just that. It's about how we handle them. When we have all these status things and we kind of look at them and say, hey, I am entitled to this. I know how it works. I am supposed to be listened to. This is the proper way we do things. We call these entitlements. The difference between entitlements and agreements is that however right and logical and makes sense your entitlements are, entitlements by definition is just things you give yourself. There is no consent. You don't ask for other people's opinion on whether you are entitled to something. But when you put that down and you ask for people's opinion and you take that into account, you have agreements. You work it out together, and you have a real team. I don't know if, like, in your life, in your ministry, have you ever felt entitled to your way, or felt like people are so feeling entitled to their ways and just gets on your nerves? How did you get your needs or expectations met? Do you just give in? Do you negotiate? Or do you claim? Lawrence Annie, the founder of Navigators, said this: you will know you have a certain attitude by how you act when you are treated like one. People don't listen to you, and people just order you around, and people walk all over you, how you react. That tells you more about whether you have a certain attitude, in, as in Luke 17, than anything else. One of the things we try to work on is what we call the levels of language vitality. In trying to work with communities, we find that there are two different ways things can go wrong. One, what if we invite them to the conversation and they end up deciding on the wrong things? The second thing is, what if we decide things for them and then they don't take our advice? So this is the first case. we have the GLP training, and then we did some testing, and we kind of had gotten an idea of how these languages are doing. So some languages are endangered. That means in a few generations, they will go into oblivion. Nobody will speak the language anymore. It will go extinct. And it happens when we see that the current children generation starting to not speak their mother tongue or their heritage language. When we see that, we call it 6B. We call it threatened. And we don't do anything to stop it. We know it's going to go downhill like the diagram shows. What we ended with was that we found several of these languages being endangered or threatened. And the normal way of doing things is we have to revive oral use of the language, because if you do any kind of literature production and the children generation and down is not using it, what will become of this literature, including the Bible? Nobody's reading it. So we try very hard to explain this and teach it to them, but what they, after all that, they come up with an idea of having a six language cluster project. These are our church people, church leaders, teachers, and so on, and pastors, and they're like, Bible translation is so important. We need to do this. And we're going to do it. And we're like, yay, that's exciting. We have people who are rooting for what we're doing and really following us on this movement. But then on the other hand, we know full well that if we do it this way, they will end up with, we spent a lot of resources on Bible translations that won't get read. So we have, one of the consultants got really frustrated. He was like, what's the point of doing all this? They just don't listen. On the other hand, we have another project in the sanctuary area of this place. We have, of this country, we have a new restart of a cluster project. That's why we are sending people to do participatory methods and all these groundwork, because in the original project, the guy did a very faithful job. He studied language. He tried to work on things, and then he ended up with some parts of the Bible translation even. But then he didn't really work with anybody. And then at some point, some people, elders from the community, said, "What are you doing? You never asked us. You're stealing our language." And that put us in a very bad situation, because we know if it would just get worse and worse, and it will take us nowhere. The translation won't get used because it's not going to be accepted. So as the organization as a whole, we come up with ways, and we realize that we need to do things in a way that really involved community. It's just a matter of how. We have endorsed a new vision that in each and every context, we will have a sustainable, locally driven movement for Bible translation and language development. It's not what we want for them. It's not our project. It's theirs. It's their language. It's their future. It's their community. We don't want to be making all these decisions, but we want them to be able to discuss and make informed decisions by involving us, by sharing our expertise and our experience. So in doing this, we really need to find ways to engage community and get people to talk about things together. And participatory methods is one of the things. When I went to Malaysia for training, it turns out it wasn't really a training. It was kind of a gathering of the practitioners. And then we tried to work things out, because this is quite a new thing. But it holds great promise, because we are actually asking people to come on board and talk about things together. And hopefully it will go a lot more sustainable than the way we used to be doing things. So we're learning from our mistakes. And when we need to train people for participatory methods to engage communities, we need facilitators to facilitate discussions, to help people draw people's ideas, to work it out where they would be able to talk and decide and think and analyze the situation together. But we need good facilitators. It's easy to learn the tools. You just have a bunch of paper, you have like strings, you have markers, you do these visual things, which is very helpful. Everybody's excited about those. But we don't have the mindset. People like the means, but they don't like the fact that they have to give up their priorities and listen to people. That's the hardest part. But when we come back to Luke chapter 17, verses 7 to 10, this parable, Jesus, we realize there's a lot of wisdom. Because if we're humble servants, we focus on what we do, we keep things in perspective, we make great participatory facilitators. We don't have people feeling entitled to their way of doing things, even though they are trying to serve God and do good things. If we have condescending experts or authorities, you end up with dictators, and people tend to try to leave dictators whenever they get a chance. You don't want to follow them. So at the end, we need to think which one is needed for God's kingdom and which one of these will you be, will you want to be in your life, in your ministry. And for those who are in a power position, you need to think how you can learn to abdicate, how to give way, how you can put yourself down and listen. If you're in the low status, if you don't have power, you have good ideas, but nobody's listening to you, well, take heart. Because think back on our Lord Jesus. Also in Luke, he actually gave us this great promise. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. Truly, I tell you, he will dress himself to serve, will have them recline at the table, and will come and wait on them. This is unheard of. First century servants, the original word is slaves. Slaves are not equal to their masters. They serve, they wait on a table, they do all the chores. They don't get this treatment. But Jesus is promising us this. He's saying, I'm not calling you servants anymore. I'm calling you friends. And we know he's not just saying it because he actually did it. In John 13, he got from the meal, took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist. And what did he do? He started washing his disciples' feet. May the word of God help us to be better servants.